Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, proudly presented by Butler Snow, where we cover topics of interest to lawyers handling appellate matters in Texas courts and beyond. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
Welcome back to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Jody Sanders.
And I'm Todd Smith.
We're back with our second episode with David Keltner, and we're going to dig into a little bit more substance today. We talked history of David and appellate law in Texas, and we're going to talk some more kind of nuts and bolts stuff today. And one of the things I want to start with is the court's charge, because I think, as you alluded to in the last episode, there are probably few people in Texas that know more about how to submit a jury charge than you do.
Oh, I didn't say quite that.
I know, I'm saying that. I get some license here. But one of the things that struck me when I first started doing appeals, because I started doing them with you, was anytime you got a new case in from a jury trial, the first thing you did was take the charge and the charge conference. And then you got multiple colored markers and multiple colored pens and you marked it up. And I had no idea what you were doing. Why don't you explain what that process is? And then maybe we can talk about why the charge is so important. Because I started doing litigation and the charge was something you did the night before it was due and got it on file. And I realize now that was not the way to do it.
I can't wait to hear this.
Then I'll tell you why. We do, when we get a charge, when you get a major verdict in, whether it's trying to sustain the verdict or reverse it, one of the things you do, you got to look at the court's charge. Everything runs through the charge. The real truth of the matter is jury's answers come from it, but the evidence is what the charge has submitted. As we know, unless there is an objection, then we have a slightly different look at it. But everything comes through the charge. You can learn a lot about the case by just looking at the charge. You can also see immediately what went wrong by looking at the charge. But what I do is, the courts in recent years, ever since Pendula versus Texaco, the Texas Supreme Court has been very interested in how cases are submitted. It had been before. In the last episode, we mentioned Pendula. We mentioned Island Recreational. We didn't talk about EB and the like. We'll talk about more about that later. But appellate courts pay more attention to the charge than anything else. So what I do is get the charge, and I get the charge conference, and I mark out in one color pen what was objected to, what was submitted, and these things get just dense with ink, as Jody is saying. And I do it all on one document, and I call it the master charge. We put it in, and our legal assistant is instructed that never leaves the file. The file goes with it, and it basically, the secretary knows who has it in any period of time. In a large case, I did one that took 2 days to do effectively with multiple parties and the like, and sometimes people do things, Todd. I want to adopt all of the objections my co-defendant made. If the judge says that's okay, there's not a whole lot of Texas law about what the impact of that is. So you've got to go in there. That can create some other problems. But I go through that, and it's a long process, but it's a process that pays a lot of dividends. You understand the case. And actually, I try to do that before I talk to the referring lawyers, so I can ask them questions about why in the hell did this go in? What was the evidence that supported this instruction? Did it come from the PJC or did it not? And I have copies of the PJC and I interlineate those as well. So I know generally where they came from. And from that, I can reverse it. I believe that I'll be able to reverse it, engineer anything but evidence admission ruling. I'll be able to determine generally what happened. And it points out to you where a dispositive motion could have been successful, ask whether it was submitted, when was it done, the whole bit, whether there was a directed verdict, all those kinds of things. And we get it in time enough, Jody, for a J&OB, we can error preserve like you did in the United Scaffolding. But we can do some additional error preservation. But the charge is the guts of a jury trial. If you really look at it, it's the result of a jury trial. And as Kleber Miller once told me, if you let me ask the question, I can tell you what the answer will be. And within some bounds, that's true.
Westlaw Edge is the standard for legal research, bringing together a legacy of quality and accurate legal research and the latest advancements in technology. First-of-its-kind features like the next generation of legal search, intelligent document analysis, integrated litigation analytics, and the most powerful citator expedite research tasks that were once incredibly complex and time-consuming. Westlaw Edge allows attorneys to deliver the fastest answers and gain the most valuable insights, providing a clear strategic advantage. Be a better attorney, make your firm better, and serve your clients better than you have before with Westlaw Edge.
Maybe we should set the stage a little bit if we're going to talk a lot about jury charge practice. We had Judge Dan Hind came on the show, and Judge Hind is the chair of the Oversight Committee for the PJC. And he had, in addition to many other things that he's done, and he had a lot of good background information for us. And I would refer our listeners back to that previous episode. But a Texas charge practice is, shall we say, different from federal charge practice. You talked about this a little bit on the last episode, but really, how did we get here?
It's an interesting deal. And I've looked at that largely because Walter Jordan, the judge I replaced on the Court of Appeals, was the original chair of the PJC committee. And Judge Jordan thought that lawyers could, in routine cases, that it was easier to do a cookbook, if you will, of charges and do it that way. And just like any recipe book, you could put in additional things as needed or to taste, modify it, in other words, modify it to your case. And I think that's best describes what the PJC process is. But what happened is, if you remember, for the longest period of time, we didn't have, in the days of the Republic and soon thereafter, we had a general verdict practice. It was, is liable and how much? And then we got away from that because no one could reverse it. And here was the problem. And it goes back to Sam Houston's time. Sam Houston was also a very gifted lawyer. And he was, at the time after the revolution in San Jacinto, very much in demand. And he would go around and try cases throughout the state, mainly East Texas, because that was the state at the time, especially criminal cases. And he would say in almost all of them, and this man was with me at San Jacinto. Sometimes that was true. Sometimes it was not. But the issue is they can never get a reversal in those kinds of cases. And you couldn't get a reversal in any kind of transactional case if you didn't, unless you were able to prove that it was literally impossible to turn out as the jury said it was. So, of course, you didn't need appellate lawyers. The whole thing was just horrible. Eventually, we just started into it right after the turn of the century and going forward into a more special issue practice. And with all things to get over-engineered, it got to be exceedingly specific. I got out of law school in 75, and in 73, the state legislature had passed comparative negligence for the first time. At that point, what was very important was the big issue was inferential rebuttal issues. And we had amended the rules of procedure to say you can't ask an inferential rebuttal question. And for those of you younger type who don't remember, inferential rebuttal was essentially asking the same question in a negative way or asking a question that would undo the general question. So if you would say was negligence, the answer to that would be, let's say, yes. But then you say, did you assume the risk? No. It would, the effect of the inferential rebuttal question would be to conflict with the general question, and you couldn't get a verdict. First of all, we started breaking those apart. Then we started, and this is in the 30s and 40s, and by the 50s and 60s, the 40s and 50s, very important to have very specific questions. And they did them element by element. Now, in an EB in the cases, Island Recreational, the other cases that came up before EB was decided, what the courts basically called those granulated charges. But what they did is took each element and submitted them individually. Now, the issue is it didn't really make any difference because if the jury was going to go for you, let's say, I'm going to keep it simple, in negligence, they'd answer everything for you. But in some circumstances, they would not do that. And so it was very specific and it wasn't who's right, who's wrong. Surprisingly, in the federal system, which came up a different way, it was more of a general charge with no real questions except one on liability, but a huge amount of instruction. And we still see that's the hangover of that still in federal court. So you can't tell what the jury did or why they did it, which gave to rise to all the, remember, poison apple charges of this was contrary to that instruction, therefore it must have impacted the jury verdict. But if the instruction was wrong, because the jury doesn't know whether an instruction is right, maybe you could get a reversal, but otherwise, basically, you couldn't. So we became more formulistic. The Pattern Jury Charge Committee actually was designed to make it easier and more general questions. But at that time, in response to the general question type of thing, we developed basically any error was harmful. And if you look at cases in the 20s and the 30s, things are getting reversed because of the minutest matter. And that was causing cases to be tried time and time again. But the reason for that was generally you couldn't tell by the time it got to the jury what the jury decided. As we came forward, we got more formulistic so we could tell exactly what the jury was deciding. But it made it harder to recover. And you can't separate out any of this from the contributory negligent rule, which where most cases were being tried in the 60s and 70s, because even a percent of negligence would bar recovery. When the state bar finally convinced the legislature to adopt comparative negligence, we begin to get rid of the inferential rebuttal issues. And Chief Justice Pope, before he was Chief Justice, said we ought not to have submitted all things this way. So things started relaxing. And of course, eventually we got to EB. But before we got to EB, we got to Oil Texaco. And if you remember, Luke Soles was the brilliant lawyer on the plaintiff's side who studied Texas Supreme Court cases and figured out a way to submit a contract issue by not whether there was a contract. But the question there was, did the parties agree? And Luke had researched that to a great extent. And the jury, evidently, to the extent that there were huge jury interviews, and there were some, said, and Joe Jamail's final argument had been, in Texas, when you shake somebody's hand over an agreement, shake each other's hand and say, we agree, you've got an agreement. That's all it takes. Remember, this was a merger of a Getty Oil into Pennzoil. And eventually, when they reach that handshake, actually what happens is Getty Oil markets itself to Texaco. Texaco eventually is successful, and Pennzoil sues, saying you interfered with our contract, long before there was a tortious interference cause of action. So the issue of an agreement, people realized, oh my God, if you ask the question right, you can get the right answer. The fascinating thing on that is that eventually the issue on which the United States Supreme Court based its grant of cert in Pennzoil Texaco was an agreement wouldn't fit the merger requirements of the SEC regulations. So that's an aside for another day. But that is basically how the charge got so important. Todd, let me follow your question, though. What then happened was trial judges knew that it was their responsibility to do the charge. At some point along the line, judges, because we give no help to trial judges. We give the judge a clerk who's got all kinds of other responsibilities, a court reporter who has same responsibilities, and no other legal help for most trial judges in state district court. So courts quickly took what we call the court's charge in the rules and made it the party's charge by requiring the parties to submit it. That's why the burden of proof came in to be so important on the issues of what your complaints are. And judges on the appellate courts quickly realized that if a plaintiff had submitted a charge and had the burden of proof on it, there was a different standard on review on appeal in dealing with that. And that's, you won't find anything really in the rules that control that as much as case law. So that changed. And as a pattern jury charge, so that became a very interesting dynamic. At the same time, our sisters and brothers in the federal court process, we're looking at ultimate questions and with a huge amount of instruction. So they went another way. Other states like Oklahoma went to an idea where their pattern jury charge is mandatory. If you fit within a particular cause of action, it is an error and automatic reversal if you deviate from the pattern jury charge, their pattern jury charges. That is true in a lot of other plain states as well, which is interesting. But what happened is, as lawyers took over the charge, we had the burden of proofs, which gave rise to the standard of review, which differ based on who had the burden at the trial court level. The assumption being behind those, I believe, is that is the person who must have submitted that question. So they're responsible for that. The objections were baked into the rules as they changed to require you to make the objection to the trial judge as a prerequisite to making it to an appellate court. That was a trial judge change because trial courts thought they were being ambushed by lawyers who weren't fully making the objections to them. Some truth to that. I'm not so sure it's not the judge's trial, it's the people's trial. So I don't completely understand that, but that's how that got baked in. I will say one thing for our system. It's logical. If you really think about it, it's absolutely logical. And if you read the rules and read them again and read them a third and fourth time, just like if you're going to understand the Bible, you have to understand Revelations, which is one of the hardest things in the world to understand. And for the Old Testament, Deuteronomy is one of the hardest things to understand. But if you read it over and over again, you get it. And it is logical. It makes it easier for me to remember. But if you think about all the technicalities,
oh my gosh,
they're all there to protect the trial judge. Like making the objection separately to each question, even though the question may be the same question may be asked. I'll tell you the story. I was in San Antonio and I trust trial, and it was being tried by Fred Bartlett Beck, and Skadden Arps was on the other side. It had really great lawyers. The other side had Dick Tinsman, who was the best salesman in the room. But the most consummate probably trial lawyer I ever saw was Fred Bartlett. And it was a clash of mighty people. Fred was organized, Dick was not, and that probably made all the difference. But when we got to the charge conference, the two things happened. One was they had submitted monopoly and attempted monopoly, and then under each had separate questions for the various actions. We started the charge conference at 5:30. Finished at 3:30 in the morning. And here's why. And on the other side were one of the DeBoses, and why am I having trouble with the names today? Richard and Jennifer Hogan. And they actually had gone to school with San Antonio at that time, had one law clerk for all of their district judges. And so they'd been Supreme Court clerks with that guy. So he gave their charge. And I had the same objection to each of the 40 deals. I had to give the objection 40 times. And I thought in the middle of it, it was John Specia, just a sweetheart of a judge. And I said, Judge, the rules say I've got to do that. And he said, that's unnecessary. I know what you mean. And I said, and I appreciate that. Let me show you the rule. He looked at the rule, and Gunn was there, too. And Gunn said, one of the funniest things you ever heard was, I said, do I dare? And I said, no, I can't. So I did the objection to each one of them separately. That whole reason for that rule is because trial judges didn't want you to bury an objection. And I would feel that I would say that's silly, except for the fact that years ago, I tried a case against a really great trial lawyer, Bob Gibbons. Bob ended up in Austin, but for the longest time, he was in West Texas. And it was an insurance case. And the judge gave his charge, and I started going through. And Bob fell asleep during the charge conference. And I'm sitting there, and I get in. I think I'm going to. And I had one good objection. I buried it in between a couple of bad ones. And Gibbons' eyes flash open. He looks at me and he said, let me hear that one again. So I think there was guilty of trying to sandbag him too. Everything, if you look at it, the idea that one objection, a good objection obscured by bad objections, that's there to protect the trial judge. The idea that you can't make a point on appeal of something you didn't raise to the charge is on the trial judge. The idea that if you had the burden of proof, you have to submit the issue instead of objecting, that's to protect the trial judge. And it's the presumption that you're going to submit your case, not the other side, to do it. Think about this. Currently, in urban counties and pretty much all rural counties that I know, judges are requiring pretrial submissions of charges, but they don't want just your questions. They want to submit the other side's questions as well. Now, think we put all kinds of disclaimers on it. We don't think there's evidence and we're not asking you to submit this and all those kinds of things. But that is absolutely contrary to the rules theory. I had a judge in Dallas recently who took the position that we needed to give the pretrial submission of the charges to the jury during the trial. I had to point out to her that one of the 270s rules says that it's submitted after the evidence closes. And she said, why is that? I said, because there might not be evidence of one or the more of these things. And we've gotten away from those things. But the reason we got there, to circle back to the original question, is for protection of trial judges. It's logical, needless at this point. We tried to change it in the Supreme Court Advisory Committee, and trial judges don't want it.
It definitely makes it harder because you have to remember to object to this, to submit to this. How does it need to be phrased? Is there a Castile problem if we do it this way? And broad form, when feasible, whatever that
means. We haven't gotten into broad form and then when feasible and done all that. There are lots of stories on cases about that. All of us know what the cases are. But eventually, Justice Pope convinced the rest of the Supreme Court that broad form practice made the most sense because fewer cases would be reversed. And Island Recreational was a rush to that judgment. Remember, Island Recreational, the issue was whether contract was fulfilled, and the defensive issue was waived. The performance was waived. And the charge doesn't have the word waiver in it or anything that looks like waiver. The defense asked for it, and it was fully argued. And the court says, but it's in there somewhere. It's in the plaintiff's liability question somewhere. In the heat to get to the result to bless broad form submission, they made the submission somewhat unfair. And Island Recreational hasn't, it's been cited occasionally for some things, but that holding has not been cited in some years, thank God. I always look, when I see it, it's one of those cases I look for and I'll search Supreme Court opinions, see if they're going to resurrect it.
It seems like really in the last 10 to 15 years, the Supreme Court's gotten more forgiving on
absolute
preservation than it has been. And they really want to take it on the merits rather than a technical point.
But let's think about that for a second. I think that's very true, Jody, the Texas Supreme Court. But the Texas Supreme Court is looking past waiver, looking past error preservation in all cases, because it can consider a broader range of cases that way. Not saying that's wrong, but that's certainly what they're doing. Dale Wainwright, when he was on the court, famously said at one CLE event, we don't much care about waiver. I think he was very honest, and I think that's exactly right. But they're now saying if you hint at it, it's enough. Think of all the cases we've talked about, the mention in summary judgment of the defensive theory, or that you disagree with one thing replaces what happens in the charge conference. You look at each one of those cases and you say, I understand that, but does it follow the rules? Absolutely not. You got to be worried about that. But I think they are more forgiving.
Yeah, I think that whole trend started in that very famous Supreme Court case authored by our now Chief Justice Payne case, which the irony of the name of that case rhyming, their jury charges are full of pain.
And they are. He was right. Payne, I think, was the theory of Payne was if the judge could understand it, that's all you need, which is wise. I think that makes great sense. The problem with that is sometimes you run into particularly obtuse judge. So what I do, take a picture of the judge, put it in the brief, says he couldn't understand anything. I think that's probably not appropriate.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, Payne was a step in the right direction. We have retreated from Payne, but it's a case that if we appellate lawyers get a case in which there's no error preservation, Payne is the first case you go to. It Payne, you find every case you need that sometimes the Supreme Court follows and sometimes it doesn't. But Jody, it's a whole other ballgame in the courts of appeals.
That's very true.
They're more serious on error preservation.
Those that don't have a discretionary docket.
They don't have to take things. They don't have to stretch to get anything. So they apply those. And I think that's good. One of the frustrations of people who either went to Baylor or took time to read the rules and understand them is that people seem to sometimes get away with things that the rules don't permit. And that's a shame. I hate that. But on the other hand, Nathan Heck was right. If the judge understood what your objection was, that ought to be enough.
It should. And it goes back to the purpose of the rules that you talked about. That's right. To protect the judge. So if you've told him everything.
I think that's right. And I think that's the way it should be. But man, we're off on a tangent on there. In the previous segment, we talked about that at one time, one of the members of the court infamously said at an advanced appellate course that it was a he doubted that there were 12 lawyers in Texas that were the 270 rules. And as I said then, immediately afterwards, it was at the Four Seasons, and there were a number of us that met at the bar and tried to determine who those 12 people were, each of us being convinced we were in the 12. We became quickly much more obsessed with the idea of who wasn't in the 12, which is maybe human nature, but says we're bad people.
There's been some effort to make it easier. And the PJCs in particular, there was a lot of work that went into adding a provision within each of the volumes, the cheat sheet on error preservation, that contains the basic rules. If it's your burden of proof, you've got, and it's omitted, you've got to submit a question. You can't just object. And the different variations on that that I remember charting out in law school to try and understand what are they talking about? Object versus request. It's still not easy to understand.
It's in the heat of battle, Todd. Oh, you're trying to think. The thing is, generally, judges are now giving lawyers time enough to look at the charge where you've had a pre-trial submission of the charge. So I can go through those and mark, where's the burden? Is there a shifting burden? Employment cases are horrible. They're shifting burdens. And if you follow the Fifth Circuit forms, really, you wonder whether the instructions match the questions. And that is something that seems horrible to me. But you're right. I think the PJC committees and the Oversight Committee both do a remarkable job. And that's a thankless task. But the people who work hard on that really are heroes.
And when in doubt, object and submit.
That's right.
And a submission always is better than an objection. Mm-hmm. But sometimes pre-dictating all those things is difficult to do.
It really is.
Oh, have you ever really handled a jury charge conference if you haven't written one out by hand?
On a legal pad?
No, that's exactly right. And everyone who's had a significant practice like this knows it. In fact, what I do is I Xerox, photocopy, or whatever you do at old school, if I'm not taking a computer or having somebody take the computer that can operate it for me, is the heading of the cases. So I can take scotch tape and scissors and I'll tape it to a legal piece of paper, write the question and submit it.
That's the voice of experience right there.
But I still carry quarters for the telephone too.
So. Just can't find anywhere to spend them.
When the stakes are high, decisions must be made quickly. And Court Surety Bond Agency is here to help. As the nation's leading surety agency specializing in supersedious bonds, CSBA can handle any size bond ranging from a small temporary injunction bond to a $1 billion appeal bond. If your client needs protection against judgment enforcement, contact CSBA or visit courtsurety.com today.
I want to go back real quick to the issue of should you prepare a complete charge. I'll say I've resisted that at some points because I don't view it as my job to do the other side's work for them. But I will say from personal experience where I think it really does come in handy to have gone through that exercise is those instances, David, in which your trial judge doesn't give you a lot of time to take a look at the charge that the court, as well as I do, what the plaintiff submits and what the defendant submits. Sometimes what the court gives you doesn't always look just like one or the other or even both. And I have found that it's better for me to know all the nuances of the other side's theories and the different variations and what may be submitted and what instructions might need to be included. It really helps me in that when you're under the gun at that moment.
I agree. I don't want to give the other side their charge. And I'd sometimes resist that, especially in more complicated cases. But I always prepare their charge and keep it myself. And I also break out for the instructions I'm going to submit, because who has the burden of proof on instruction can become tricky. So you have to assume you do. And generally, I find I was in one very good judge's court in Houston. And she looked at me and said, if you want it, you must have had the burden on it. And you're thinking, well, under that theory. So we went around about that, but you got to be careful.
I have a follow-up question that's really pretty general. And maybe there's not a great way to answer it, but I'm going to, since I've got the opportunity to pick the great David Keltner's brain about jury charges, I'm going to do it anyway. So is there a general rule? We talked generally about the PJCs and the value that they bring. It's not quite paint by numbers, but in most cases, it'll take you pretty far down the road. What are your thoughts on when it's appropriate to deviate from the PJC?
I haven't been on PJC, various PJC committees for years. I think I quite often deviate. I am getting less acceptance from judges as time goes on. They will tell you if it's not in the PJC, I'm not going to submit it. Don't even ask me. And if I think it's important to preserve an era, I will submit it and say, Judge, I know you didn't want this. This is not PJC. It's based loosely on 1.203 and all those things, but it's not PJC. And I'm going to submit them. But I think, first off, two things are important. Submit the case that was tried. If it is based on specific facts, don't submit the extraneous things in the PJC. PJC is by nature general. Let's make it specific to the facts of the case so the jury is not tempted to go outside the record about what they think. That's one. Two, Todd, I think that if the PJC doesn't deal with the situation you have, and that happens not infrequently, borrow from the PJC's one structure to general submissions and submit everything you have with case law that says this is the law. That is the time to deviate. Trying to think of specific examples, none come quite to mind. Oh, one does. You have a retaliation claim in an employment law context, but the plaintiff is filing the lawsuit, but the plaintiff filed the first lawsuit. Certainly you're protected in filing a second lawsuit as a counterclaim to the first. But there's nothing in the employment law statutes or the Fifth Circuit charges deals with that at all. The way to preserve it, I think, is to go in and say, that's not a legitimate cause of action for retaliation. You should take instruction regarding the counterclaim out. But if not, you're instructed that you had a constitutional right to file a counterclaim and do these things. And it's agreeable unless it's not reasonably based in law and fact. You'll find the last part in some of the retaliation clauses and Supreme Court cases, but you won't find the whole thing related to a counterclaim. I think that kind of situation is when you depart from the PJC. That makes sense?
It does. Absolutely. Yeah. And what you said also about submitting the case that was tried makes sense. If you've got a straight up breach of contract case, don't try it as a fraud case.
No, that's exactly right. And you don't need every question that's asked in a breach of contract, did someone comply with X? If we know what they're claiming the breach is, why don't we limit it to that instead of the contract itself?
Yeah.
That's the kind of thing I'm talking about, because what may happen is some extraneous facts come in that deal with performance or just the other guy's a bad guy. And you'll have a juror more likely than not come out and say, yeah, but he was a jerk on X. That's got to be a breach of contract. So
you have to be careful with causes of action, because as we've seen, the Supreme Court has no problem saying you just flat submitted the wrong cause of action. Too bad for you.
And we especially have had that in premises cases.
Negligence.
Oh, yeah.
and that's it. But we've seen it in contract cases, too, when the wrong things are submitted. Red Deer, classic example of that, when traditionally when you don't have production in playing quantities, it's based on the last day that there was production in paying quantities. But the contract varied that. You got to be real careful with those kinds of things, and because the Supreme Court is, and God love them for it.
Yeah. I want to switch over and talk about the other thing that I have seen you do more than I think any other lawyer I know, which is oral arguments. And it's something that you do better than just about any other lawyer I know. You're not going to take credit for it, but you do. And so I want to talk about, I guess, first how you prepare for oral argument and then your thoughts and tips on giving the most effective oral argument.
there are a lot of difference between trying lawsuits and doing appeals. But one of the things that great trial lawyers do is reduce everything to its lowest common denominator. They do it for the burden of persuasion. And I think that applies to appeals. I think we ought to make the decision for the Court of Appeals as easy as we can make it and say, we're right because of X. That's important. That's difficult to do. You generally have to write a very complex, complicated brief to be able to, at least I do, be able to reduce it to its lowest common denominator. David Gunn does a very good job at that. David comes by it naturally. I've got to structure myself into it. Second thing on oral argument is you need to think like your audience. They're there to write an opinion that fits within the fabric of the law that's woven in with other cases, especially when you're at the Supreme Court. If you're not dealing with that issue, you're not helping the court do its job. It's got to answer a question and it's got to be satisfied or write why this fits within other case law, or if it doesn't, create an exception. You've got to do that. And that needs to be part of your simple explanation to the court. And so I think those are major things. The other thing that I see a court being confused about at the end of oral argument, more often than I would suspect, is wanting to know what you want. And I don't know how many times I've been in a courthouse, either in my arguments or other people's arguments, at the end of it, one of the judges saying, I want to make sure what you want. Or at the Texas Supreme Court saying, would you be happy with a remand rather than a render? Because that's really what your argument is. The other thing I think is this. I think you've got to understand what the standard of review on appeal is for each one of your issues and fully understand that. And that sounds easy, and it generally is, but you have to operate within those frameworks. And I think that's very important. Preparing for that 15 minutes is something where my son, who's in law school and about to graduate, you know, a clerk for the Court of Criminal Appeals, but he asked me about one matter, and I had over 200 hours preparing for one oral argument for 15 minutes. My God, the price per minute was prohibitive. But what happened in that case was I got out, may it please the court. And boom, questions. And you had to be able to respond with their prior decisions. And remember your audience. And let me give you examples of that. If you're arguing to a three-person court of appeals, that's a finite thing. You should learn everything you need to know about those people by reading prior opinions in similar cases, but just generally know. And book them. I mean, see what their practice was, all those kinds of things. In the Supreme Court recently, we've had a change of over a period of 5 years of four judges. And that's changed the dynamic of the court. Some people generally tend to vote with others. That's changed dramatically. The viewpoint of three of the judges, or two of the new judges that brought a third along, have changed a more fundamentalist view of pretty much everything, which is, I'm not critical at all of that. It's just that you've got to know that's there. And so knowing the audience is extremely important. And when you're answering questions that in one recent case, I had 20 questions in 15 minutes. There's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, it's just a lot.
First off, you want to encourage questions, because if a court has any doubt about what it wants to do, you need to be able to explain why you think you're right. If you don't know what their concerns are, you can't address them. So I build in pauses that invite and phrases right before the pause to invite questions. And I want to know whether they agree or disagree with a major premise I'm going to make. If they disagree, my argument changes. If they agree, we continue down the line we're going. But remember that one judge may ask you a question, and if you answer favorably to what you think he or she wants, you may be losing a vote, another vote. So you got to be careful with that. If the court is unsure on one issue and their prior decisions say that or demonstrate it, they don't want to say that they're not all in agreement. And you might need to say, Your Honor, of course, in Barrett-Shaver, the court was splintered on that issue. And if you'll recall, Justice, this, you held Y, and just why you had another view. We think you don't have to decide that matter here, because under either of your theories, this is the way you would interpret this phrase. But you have to sometimes see advocates glomming on to one question, thinking it is adversarial, trying to convince that one judge, and they're losing the two votes over here they had to have. And that's, I think, terribly important. If you are in a court and you're criticizing prior opinions, be ready for the question, should we reverse our previous case? Almost always you want that answer to be no, it's not necessary. You can provide an exception or whatever, but be ready for those matters.
One of the things that I think you do particularly well is concessions.
I think you
just made one, right?
Yeah, that's right. I think it's important to concede. I think, and let me tell you, I watched Mike Catchell do this for a long period of time and Greg Coleman, and both of them had an ability to say, in especially the hypothetical questions, if we were to decide this, you would lose, right? And even in very hostile courts, I saw both Greg and Mike say, absolutely, and stick to that gun. First off, they know you're being honest with them. Two, they think of, he's got a way to get around this. They're likely to ask you that question next. If that's right, how do you deal with this? Which is exactly the question I wanted, because I want to explain something. Sometimes we forget that, especially at the Texas Supreme Court and certainly the Fifth Circuit as well, in en banc especially, the judges are talking to each other. They're not necessarily talking to you and answering questions, and they won't ask a question. They'll say, the law, certainly, A, B, C, and D. And what do you say? Regardless of that, you can't say that. But what you have to say is, Your Honor, you have to know enough to be able to say, I understand your justice opinion on that may put that issue in some doubt. Is that what you were referring? And if the answer is yes, you give you, okay, this is what I need to decide. One of the worst arguments I ever heard was a lawyer who's no longer living, whose name will be, I won't mention, to protect the guilty. I've just got a huge amount of questions from one judge, and it was on a very technical issue relating to firearms. And it had nothing to do with the appeal. And the lawyer said, Justice Blank, I know you're not with me on this case. Would you mind if I answered other judges' questions? Another one with another lawyer. Be stoic. Have a stoic face when you're sitting at the counsel table. Justice Baker stopped an argument that I was making and addressed the lawyer sitting at the other table and said, if you make one more grimace or roll your eyes, and he said, you're not going to get your rebuttal. Hey, that wasn't the Chief Justice at the time. But another time I had the Chief Justice, this is Greenhill, stop an oral argument so a lawyer could compose himself. And he was getting very agitated, starting to yell and things like that. You never want to do that. You want the court to consider you someone who is there to help them, because they know you're an advocate, but you truly are there to help them reach a decision, hopefully in your client's viewpoint.
Okay, I'm going to interject and ask for another Keltner take on something. I don't get the benefit of being down the hall from you all the time like Jody does. What is the Keltner view on visuals at oral argument?
I don't like them as much as most people like them. Some of our colleagues use charts in every matter. At Texas Supreme Court, that's difficult to do, number one, given the layout of the courtroom. And doing that, you can't, this is going to be on audio, you can't see it, but pointing to a chart can be problematic. So I don't like to use them. If I'm going to do something, I'll do a bench book. And the bench book will have what I need in it. There are visceral reactions, though, to bench books. Some of the judges believe if we're talking about a statute or a contract, you've got that in it, man, it's all over your brief. I don't need to see it again. You're going to highlight it just like you did in your brief. Don't show that to me again. We can't get in evidence outside the record. Generally, I don't think they're all that helpful. We can't do power. I have seen very good lawyers try to do PowerPoint presentations to court of appeals, I've never seen it work. If one's going to do it, they got to be simple bullet point kinds of thing. Like, for example, if someone is saying there's no evidence of something, I may take out bullet points that disprove that with record citations and hand it to them and just say, he's going to say yes, I'm going to say no. Look at these and make your judgment. So I generally don't like it. But sometimes everything goes out the window. All of us have had bad times, made way too many oral arguments, or maybe making so many bad things happen. But I was in the Fifth Circuit once with an interesting panel, and the chief judge, who happened at that time to be the chief judge of the circuit as well, that the Fifth Circuit changes up how it does things periodically. And during that period of time, they were announcing, just like in the Texas Supreme Court, the next counsel. So the marshal, who was a clerk staff, stands up and said, man, this will be David Keltner for the appellees. No, appellants. We were appellants. Or petitioners. We were appellants. And I stood up and walked to the podium, opened my notebook, and said, may it please the court. And the chief judge looked up and said, you're not David Keltner. And so I laughed and I was struggling for an answer. And the best answer I could come up with is, when I woke up, I didn't feel like myself. And I thought, no, I'm not going to do that. And fortunately for me, the judge sitting to her right said, no, that's David. That's him. And the other judge, both Texas judges, said, yeah, that's David Kelton. They start laughing. The senior judge gets, not the current chief judge, by the way, gets angry, very angry. It did not go well for the rest of the time. But I've had disrespectful comments. I've had good comments. I've had bad ones. I had once was arguing out of state, and a judge said, we don't much care what rich Texas lawyers think about this. And my response was, you got one of those right. And everybody laughed, and it didn't go very well with him either. Things can be very testy. We're in an era, looking at the United States Supreme Court, and you can see this. There are a lot of judges that ask a number of questions in cases they're specifically interested in. But Todd, generally, they're not advocates. They may be talking to other judges on the court. They may be talking posterity. Newer judges feel the need to get on one side and be an advocate. In knowing your audience, you have to know that and be prepared for it. And defending an opinion that has yet to be written. So it's good to know that they're hostile. It's argued recently out of state in which that was very much the case. And I was able to finally get that judge laughing about a matter. And the way I did it was saying that, judge, you write them and I read them. And what you think about what you meant is more important than I do. But the case you're holding says A, B, C, and D. And looked at her, she started laughing. I said, so I think. Another judge jumps in and says, I think that's exactly what we meant. And so you get your point across that way. I once had to argue a case in the Supreme Court, and it was whether a certain one of those claw machines that the kids use and drop down to get a little toy and everything, whether that felt within that was an illegal lottery. And there's a provision in the tax code called the fuzzy animal exception. And so I looked at the Supreme Court and I said, I never thought I'd be here talking about fuzzy animals, but here we are. Humor's okay, but more often you got to be real scarce with it and probably not do it much. I don't know what else to do.
I think that's great.
Here's the one thing, the last thing I'm going to say. There are a bunch of finites in appellate work, especially in oral argument. The record is the record, but it's finite. It is possible for you to know it better than anybody else, even the people that had tried the case. The case law is finite. You are capable of knowing more about the case law than anybody else, including the people who wrote the cases. And actually, you may be in a better position to meld them all together than the judges who actually wrote them. With those finites, it's literally impossible for you, if you work hard, to know more than anybody else in the universe about your case when it is argued. And when the court gets the idea that you'll concede what you need to, but that you know the ins and outs and it's okay for the case to turn out your way, you succeeded. That's the theory about oral argument.
I like that a lot. Yeah. That's one of the things that draws some people to appellate work is the finites. You don't have all the extraneous discovery battles and lots of motion practice and all the things that go into the product that the jury sees. Once the jury renders its verdict and the judgment gets signed, everything is locked in and your universe is limited, which is both a beauty and a horrible part of appellate work at the same time.
Now, sometimes there, you think there's not enough, and sometimes there isn't. The most nervous I've ever been is when I know there's something I haven't quite mastered yet, and I'm thinking it's not going to be important to the court. And man, I'm going to get a question on this. And I'm nervous before every hearing, whether it be a special exception or making an oral argument. But hopefully my preparation has been such that when I open my mouth, all of that nervousness and anxiety goes away. And I hope most of the time that's true. I think it is. But not all the time.
David, you've been so generous with your time. We managed to turn it into not just one, but two episodes. And we're so grateful to you for spending the time with us. And Jody and I have been talking a lot over the last almost 3 years. We really would like to have you on the show. And we might have to get you back. I don't think we've tapped the full.
No, definitely not. There's more.
It's our tradition that before we conclude with a guest, that we give them an opportunity to offer up a quick tip or a war story. Was there something that you'd like to leave our conversation with today that would be interesting?
Fifth Circuit was one. My worst time, and this may take a little time, you may have to cut this, but I was involved in Marshall, Texas in a case that had taken 4 months to try. And I was there just solely for preservation purposes. And we got an unfortunate verdict and that ended up in an unfortunate judgment. And Todd, I filed a motion for a new trial, but did not ask for it being set. And so the judge said it. So I called the clerk and said, there's nothing in this that's not mentioned in JNOB except for preservation issues. I'm happy to appear. She says, no, the judge wants to have a hearing. So I drove out to Marshall, and there were, I cannot tell you how many lawyers. There was every good lawyer in Marshall, and there are a lot of them. We had Sam Baxter, Doyle Curry, Franklin Jones, Carl Roth on the other side. On our side, we had someone from who's now with Gibson Dunn, and then a lawyer from West Texas. I can't ever figure out why he was there, and a Kansas City lawyer. And we had a rather has now become a famous jury consultant that has gone on to other things. So I stand up to make my argument and say, Judge, you've actually ruled on all these before, and I'm happy to go over them. But if you have any questions, feel free to answer them. She said, just a minute. She said, I want you to stand right there. And she said, I'm going to invite the district attorney in. Todd, that's never a good sign. So the district attorney comes in, and he comes in with one other guy, and they're carrying huge amounts of things. I'm thinking, what is this? And it turns out there are photographs of the jurors at their homes, at their businesses, and photographs of the judge, some of which are inside her house. And they were taken by an investigator for our side, who evidently was convinced that something amiss was going on. But they had followed jurors. They had followed the judge. They'd gotten inside the judge's house when the judge was there. And then the story was that they put this guy on and raised his hands, testifies. He's gone to an attorney, a county attorneys association meeting they take. So you'll know they take their investigators with them for these conventions. And there is some drinking going on and the like. And our guy, who I never knew existed, never saw him as far as I know, in those 4 months, shows up and says he's convinced the judge is on the take and these guys know it too, and he's looking for information. Then how they get the photographs is he hadn't developed the film, so he takes them to a photomat store And the photomat attendant just happens to be a friend of the judge's in their Sunday school class. So he makes two copies, one for the judge, one for our guy. By the time I look up, one of the lawyers and the jury consultant had run out of the courtroom. The doors were flapping back and forth. And the judge asked me, Todd, do you have an explanation for this? That was my worst afternoon as a lawyer. And my explanation was, I said, Judge, you deserve one. I just don't have it. And she said, David, if you could see the look on your face, you'd know that I know you had no idea about any of this. But it was an exciting day in the practice of law.
I think that qualifies as a war story.
I think it does.
Bad day.
Well, we really appreciate it. And until the next time we have you back for another topic, we really appreciate it.
My pleasure to be here.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, presented by Butler Snow. If you're enjoying the show, please recommend it to your colleagues or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We appreciate everyone who has rated the show and otherwise supported us so far. To stay in touch, suggest topics, ask questions, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at texapplawpod.com or tweet us at texapplawpod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.